Good evening, everyone. And for those of you we can see, hello. And for those of you we can't see, hello. I would say certainly that Dr. Davis has been one of the most iconic women in the struggle for blacks in this country. And I certainly don't want to romanticize or get real nostalgic about what the myth and the legend meant to me. But I certainly hope that this evening you, as young people, most of you that are here, can listen for those life lessons that, you know, can really serve as something inspirational and foundational for you tonight. So that's really what we'd like to accomplish. Dr. Davis, I would therefore like to begin our conversation by reflecting on how you became so empowered as a young woman of 25, an assistant professor at UCLA. How did you find the will and the force to stand up to the powers that be, Governor Reagan, et cetera? And I'd like you to share that will with us, given some of the following considerations. So there's, I think, several things that, you know, kind of set the foundation for you to be who you became. The first is, let's kind of start with the fact that you were born in Birmingham, Alabama, in the Jim Crow South. And so there's, you know, some context about how you got out of Alabama and traveled the world.
Yeah, I was born in Birmingham, Alabama. It seems that Birmingham may be in the house this evening. Is that right? Well, first of all, let me say good evening to everyone. It's really wonderful to be here in LA at USC. I almost said UCSC because that's my home campus, and everyone always confuses UCSC and USC. And I want to thank all of the sponsors who were involved in organizing this event. Sometimes you have to give thanks for having been ensconced in difficult situations. And so, of course, when we think about the era of segregation and Jim Crow and the racist violence, many of you have seen Selma, so that's on your mind now. You think, how horrible. But I often am aware of the fact that had I not grown up under those conditions, I would not be who I am today. Mm-hmm. And I'm also thankful because I had the opportunity to be taught by teachers who were really concerned that we express pride in who we were, that we not assent to the definitions of what it meant to be black that were offered us by dominant society. So I had an amazing education. As a matter of fact, whenever we sang the Star Spangled Banner, we also sang the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing, which was about freedom and about struggle.
I think it's, you know, of note that Dr. Davis actually traveled early in her life and studied went to school not only in Alabama, but then New York. And then as a college student, actually studied abroad. So this is something that we talk about now. Many students who, you know, certainly deal with me every day, I constantly push them to study abroad. But when you were in your studies abroad, what was it like for you, you know, certainly being an African-American early on in international study, and how did you deal with people who may not have been really familiar with an African-American student abroad?
Well, okay. Let me see if I can very succinctly describe my trajectory. When I was in Birmingham as a very young person, I always knew that I wanted to travel. And so initially, I assumed that If I went to the north, following the journeys of escaped slaves, mm-hmm. that I would find freedom. And so I ended up going to high school, last 2 years of high school in New York. But I didn't find freedom. I found a more sophisticated kind of racism.
Yes, yes.
And so I think it was at that point I said, well, I need to travel elsewhere in the world. I was very interested in French and, you know, reading about the French Revolution, which I identified with more than the American Revolution, and mm-hmm. you know, liberté, égalité, fraternité. Mm-hmm. And so I traveled to France, thinking that perhaps I would find freedom there. Mm-hmm. But it was at the... it was precisely at the moment of the Algerian Revolution. And as a matter of fact, my first trip to France, I lived in a little chambre de bonne next door to a group of women from Martinique. Uh-huh. And they warned me that I might be mistaken for an Algerian. And at that time, Algerians were being killed on the street. Uh-huh. So I went to France looking for freedom, and I found the Algerian Revolution. I always say I went looking for liberté, égalité, fraternité, and I found solidarité. Mm-hmm. I found solidarity mm-hmm. with world revolutions. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important, you know, that you start to really note that when you're young like this and you're open to experiences, this is when the kernels of your belief system start to kind of marinate, and that certainly sounds like it was the case for you. So with these experiences, or were there significant experiences that shaped your thinking as a free thinker, so to speak, especially given your travels?
Well, I think that I always thought of myself as a part of a community. And I'm really thankful for growing up under those conditions because I never thought of myself as an isolated individual. Mm. So it really wasn't about my becoming something that set me apart from everyone else. Yeah. It was about, you know, using the knowledge that I acquired, using whatever talents and skills I had to further the struggle for freedom. I had the good fortune to grow up in a family where both my mother and father were teachers. So the connection between education and liberation was imposed upon me from a very young age. My mother taught all of us to read by the time we were two or three. Mm-hmm. If we couldn't read by the time we were three, then that was considered to be a serious defect.
As it should have been. But then, let's say, when you started to find your voice and you knew that your voice was different than the typical American ideal, when did you start really having the courage, your own personal courage with that voice? And was it your family that was the first to sustain you in that independent voice, even as a dissident? Or who were your support systems?
Well, you know, I never really thought of myself mm-hmm. as an individual who was speaking out against the status quo. Mm-hmm. I thought of myself always as a part of a community of people. So it wasn't so much a question of having to find courage as an individual. This is just the way it was.
Yes.
I grew up in a community that was outcast. And so everyone, so to speak, had to find ways of consolidating a community that would preserve all of us.
Absolutely.
And I've always, even today, I feel myself most myself when I'm a part of a larger community of struggle for justice, equality, and freedom.
So contextually, of course, you know, 30-ish years ago, 40-ish years ago, you know, time flies. But there was so much going on that, you know, true to what you're saying, especially within the Black demographic, the voice that you were trying to find was really one that obviously didn't fit, you know, the prevailing status quo. So I hope that as you leave here tonight, especially younger people, you go back and you really do some reading and some reflecting on why that might have been the case. So I want to move forward in
time.
Let
me just say, I've actually never felt comfortable accepting the status quo.
Yeah, so. Yeah, neither did I, yeah. Because it didn't fit.
And I think it's okay to be a part of what has often been called the other America. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, not mm-hmm. the dominant America. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I make this point because there is a whole history of not only African American struggle for freedom, but when one considers this country was built on the colonization of indigenous inhabitants.
Yes. And yes. We can acknowledge that tonight, absolutely.
So yeah. We have to legitimize and validate that history, which I think is even more important than the dominant history.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and we're gonna jump to some of those questions as well. Tonight, as we were reflecting back in the green room is of particular significance, or possibly particular significance to Dr. Davis, because on this day, the 23rd of February, Dr. Davis was released from jail after spending nearly 2 years in incarceration as a political prisoner. So I wonder what your thoughts are about that term, political prisoner, what your thoughts are about that time, how it feels, does it feel like yesterday? And is the term political prisoner applicable today as it was then?
Well, first of all, February 23rd. Mm-hmm. Okay, I was released on bail. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. February 23rd, 1972. And I realized on that day that that was also the birthday of Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois. So this is Du Bois' birthday today. And can I tell the story of how I was released
to
unveil?
Because we have young people that have not heard the story.
And it's also a story about solidarity. It's a story about community. It's a story about what it means to build movements and the reach of those movements. And this is not the first time I've told this story, of course. But I'll abbreviate it by saying that while I was in jail, some of the members of the committee to free Angela Davis and all political prisoners, because mm-hmm. it wasn't just me, it was all political prisoners, had the idea that they should develop a campaign for bail. And, you know, I'm sitting in jail, and I thought it was a terrible idea. And I said, why are you going to spend all of this time organizing a campaign for bail when you know that I cannot be bailed out? I've been charged with 3 capital offenses, therefore 3 non-bailable offenses, right? Murder, kidnapping, conspiracy. So I said, so you know, why do you want to, you know, organize a campaign for bail? But I was in jail, so what did I know? And they listened to me, and they went on and organized it anyway. And as it turned out, it was a brilliant idea because at that time, the impact of anti-communism was still so strong that there were many people who were very reluctant to identify themselves with me because they didn't want to be considered communist sympathizers. But they could agree that I should have the right to be released on bail. So they collected signatures on petitions all over the country, all over the world. And as I've often pointed out, Aretha Franklin said that if I got released on bail, if the judge ordered me released, that she would pay for it. She would pay the bail. And then suddenly, without any warning, the capital punishment was declared unconstitutional in the state of California for a little while. And so there was a window of about a week before the courts ruled that all previously non-bailable offenses would remain ineligible for bail. And Aretha was out of the country.
She was not the one who bailed
you out. Because people tried to get in touch with her. She was in the Caribbean, and there was no way to get money. You know, it wasn't like it is now. Capital didn't flow so easily over national borders. And so no one knew what to do. What are we going to do? It was $100,000, which was equivalent to more than $1 million, right? If we want to think in terms of today's. And this man by the name of Roger McAfee, a white farmer from Fresno, California, showed up at my lawyer's office and said he wanted to put up his farm for my bail. It was an amazing thing. That's how I got out.
I always wondered,
that's
did he know you, or he just...
No, he didn't know me.
I could never figure that out.
He was... I mean, the reason I say it's a story about the reach of movements, mm-hmm. he was touched mm-hmm. by all of the organizing that people were doing. He didn't know me personally. We had never met. But he was not only willing to put up his farm for bail, which he did, mm-hmm. but he was willing to accept the consequences, which were that the Ku Klux Klan shot some of his animals, and members of the campaign around my freedom had to go and help him protect his farm for many, many months after that.
Well, politics at that time was certainly ultra-conservative, or I would say uber-conservative now, but since, and Dr. Davis, of course, was, as you know, acquitted on all of those charges. But since your acquittal...
That's right.
I
should tell you that my co-defendant was not acquitted. Mm-hmm. And you mm-hmm. asked the question about political prisoners.
Yes.
Rochelle McGee, who was my co-defendant,
yes.
is still in prison. Which means that he has been in prison more than 50 years. And of course he's a political prisoner. The term, yes, it continues to be used. I can name others. Leonard Peltier, American Indian Movement activist, who is one of the longest held political prisoners in this country. Mumia Abu-Jamal, fortunately is no longer facing capital punishment, but he still faces death in prison. Oftentimes we talk about life in prison without possibility of parole, and people think about that as an alternative to the death penalty, but that's another death sentence. That's like being sentenced to die mm-hmm. in prison. And next month I'm going to visit Mondo Waylanga and Edward Poindexter, who were active in the Black Panther Party in the late 60s and the early 70s, they are still in prison in Nebraska. We could spend the rest of the time allotted us talking about political prisoners. Assata Shakur in Cuba.
Yes. So I think it's good to just to acknowledge that there are political prisoners in this country. Since your acquittal, you travel to places like Cuba, the Soviet Union, and in fact, in 1979, you received the Lenin Peace Prize. And I would like you to talk about why you think they celebrated you versus the fact that you were so vilified here in the United States during that same time.
Yeah, it was actually quite remarkable that in all of the then socialist countries, there were massive campaigns for my freedom. The Soviet Union, the German Democratic Republic, as a matter of fact, in the what was then the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, there was a campaign among students, elementary school students, to send me 1 million roses on my birthday. And so they wrote postcards and drew pictures of roses, and I got at least 1 million, probably more than 1 million. As a matter of fact, all of those postcards are in the archives in Stanford. But what's interesting is that in the meantime, I've met adults who have told me about the experience of feeling a part of a global movement when they were younger. And you know, you don't think about the fact that something like that can shape people's lives.
Absolutely.
And so some years ago, I went back to Germany. Well, I've been several times, but I went to East Germany and Leipzig and Dresden and some of those cities where I met people who had, they brought me real roses. And they told me that as children, they had written me postcards, and they had never forgotten that act of sending those postcards. So, yeah, that was international solidarity.
You are listening to Dr. Michelle Turner and Professor Angela Davis in conversation at the University of Southern California on Monday, February 23rd, 2015. For a copy of this program or any other program in our collection, go to fromthevaultradio.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. You can always browse our entire collection at pacificaradioarchives.org. We invite you to join us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search Pacifica Radio Archives to help spread the word about our historic recordings going back to 1949. And now back to our program with Dr. Michelle Turner and Professor Angela Davis from the campus of the University of Southern California. Special thanks to Cynthia Mataflores, Amanda Schmidt, and the rest of the wonderful USC staff for making this recording possible.
He's a child in a world that won't be kind. See him run just for other men's needs. See him try and turn the tide in every way he can. But see him get burned.
I'm going to switch gears just a little bit, but kind of coming from this topic of how we revere solidarity and how we think about that concept either being forgivable or not. So I've always thought that it was very ironic that both you and Muhammad Ali always connected, for instance, the Vietnam War to being more than just a war about communism, but connected it to the oppression of black and brown people here in this country. And what's interesting to me is that Mr. Ali is so revered today. And what is also very admired, very central to connection with him is this aspect of black pride, but not yet for you. Or do you think that that narrative now is changing for you? What your thoughts might be about that?
You mean in terms of how?
In terms of how you used to speak about the war in Vietnam being a war that really focused on imperialism when there were actually acts of oppression.
Well, it was both. It was imperialism, but mm-hmm. the aggression against the Vietnamese people mm-hmm. was very much linked to aggression against black communities and mm-hmm. communities of color. I can remember right here in Los Angeles when the Black Panther Party was attacked by SWAT, which marked the first appearance of SWAT. Nobody knew about SWAT in those days. And these were former Green Berets and people who had participated in the war in Vietnam. And so we were talking about the war at home. We were talking about the war in Vietnam and the war at home. And unfortunately, it seems as if we're still confronted with the same, you know, kind of connection between the war on people in Iraq and Afghanistan, the continued aggression against the Palestinian people and occupied Palestine, and the connections with racist violence that unfolds, as we know, in this country, and not only in, you know, Ferguson and New York, but right here in Los Angeles, over the country.
That's right. And certainly looking at the responses to violence here, we've seen Green Berets, we've seen SWAT, we've seen this even in our own communities at different levels. You know, so I wanted to talk about some of the things that you've written about. You're such a prolific writer. And one of the things that you do speak about is this notion, you challenge the notion of a colorblind society, and you say that it is not something that should be an accepted solution for racism or for racist institutions. And you say that this notion of colorblind society actually absolves the individual or the institution from having to look at the phenomenon of race. And if you could talk a little bit about the phenomenon of race and your thinking about why that's such an important distinction today.
Well, you know, the ideology of colorblindness, and it is an ideology, mm-hmm. because it's not about creating racial equality. I see the role of colorblindness as being that of preventing people from understanding the depths of racism.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because racism is not simply about the color of an individual's skin. It's about structures of oppression and repression. And today, I would say that it is impossible really to understand the nature of racism, anti-black racism, anti-Latino racism, anti-Asian racism, unless we also recognize the role that the so-called war against terror has played. And so it means that we really have to begin to look at anti-Arab and anti-Muslim racism as playing a central role in the production and reproduction of racism and racist violence mm-hmm. today. Mm-hmm. And so if we say that that it's only about colorblindness, where does that get us? What does that do? It simply makes us incapable of understanding the complexities of racism, the history of racism. Just last week, a report was released by the Equal Justice Initiative, which is headed by Brian Stevens, a really amazing organization. And it's about the history of lynching in this country. And I mentioned this because I just got in from New Orleans last night. No, this afternoon, today.
Today.
I arrived today. And yesterday, I took a long walk with a friend of mine. And I walked along Jefferson Davis Parkway and saw this huge statue of Jefferson Davis and other sculptures of Confederate generals. All over the South, you see you see monuments to white supremacy.
Yes.
And where will you find a marker that says that a person was lynched here? And so the Equal Justice Initiative has this campaign now to at least establish some markers and some small monuments to remind people that there were thousands and thousands of lynchings in this country. We cannot forget that. Colorblindness forgets about that history.
Right, right. Lynching really only being not even a generation old, which I just think is so mind-blowing. Now, with regard to the many isms that we see and that we try to solve, I mean, today the response typically is that, you know, someone will engage and organize in via social media calls to action, which is wonderful, frankly, in that we get to also see these very large collective responses nationwide. And, you know, I think there are some lessons in that. I mean, I think we can see that there is a heightened awareness about issues such as the I Can't Breathe campaign, the Ferguson response, and even Black Lives Matter now. But do you think, frankly, in order for there to be the kind of needed diplomacy that can create change in policy, that this can be done with these mass collective movements, but no central organizing figure, different from in...
This is a different era. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important for those of us who have had the opportunity to witness different moments in the development of movements, freedom movements. It's important to recognize, and for young people as well, who don't have that history, but who see films like Selma and who read the history books and think about movements as happening only in a very specific way, only as a consequence of a powerful leader.
Yeah.
And what I thought, incidentally, about the film Selma, that what I thought was so good about that film is that the filmmaker, the director, Ava DuVernay, attempted to demonstrate that it wasn't just about Dr. Martin Luther King, and as amazing as Dr. King was, and he deserves all of the praise that we have given him over the years, but he was not the person who created that movement. He was the person who was the spokesperson for the movement.
Yes.
And we saw like Amelia Boynton, right, who is, how old is she now? 103? She's still alive. And she's still active. And I mean, I guess the point that I'm making is that two often we don't give credit to those who created the movement, who organized the movement, mm-hmm. who did the work that made it possible. And many of them were women. Mm-hmm. So. So it's very interesting, isn't it, that the women drop out of history, right?
Yes. Yes.
So we have to beware of these masculinist modes of representing mm-hmm. history. Mm-hmm. And the great leader framework is a masculinist framework.
Absolutely.
It's a masculinist yes. framework. Also, we have recently seen with Occupy and with the movements that the organizations, the formations that have emerged, and in Florida you have the Dream Defenders, you know, Philip Agnew and others. You have there's a formation in Chicago. There's a We Charge Genocide formation. A lot of amazing organizations of young people who are really trying to do it differently. Mm-hmm. And Patrice Cullors, Black Lives Matter. And Patrice is from LA, so, you know, many of you have encountered her and her amazing work. She was involved in organizing the Coalition Against the Sheriffs, Against the Sheriff Violence, Coalition Against Sheriff Violence, in this city, in this county. And so I think that notion of the grassroots organizing, mm-hmm. Defining what it means to build movements is something that we should really take seriously now.
I totally agree. And just getting back to the movie Selma, and my kids know this because I know I sound like a broken record to them, but one of the interesting things about that movie was that, of course, you know the story of Dr. Martin Luther King, but you also saw two other people in that movie that didn't really get a lot of storytelling. One of them, of course, was John Lewis, and he did get some recognition in the movie. But the other one was Stokely Carmichael, who you didn't even know that's who he was in that movie, you know, who really did give birth to the movement, one of the leaders of the movement. But there was no mention of him really in that movie, even though he was standing there with John Lewis, and I always thought that was interesting. However, that's my story. So you still continue to be a leading advocate against oppression today. What are some of your priorities today and why?
Well, I've been doing work in a number of movements, but especially in the abolitionist movement against yes. The prison industrial complex.
Mm-hmm. And I'd love you to talk about that. Yes.
And did you all see the Oscars last night?
No.
I know a lot of people boycotted the Oscars, especially because of the lack of attention to Selma and to black filmmakers and actors. But John Legend was absolutely incredible last night. So it was worth. I went to sleep after I saw the, you know.
Well, we'll replay that part.
Yeah, yeah. Because he not only talked about the importance of that song that he co-wrote with Common Glory, which is an incredible song. It should have gotten an Oscar. Mm-hmm. But he pointed out that we are still in the midst of this huge crisis of over-incarceration, mass incarceration. And he used Michelle Alexander's point of about the fact that there are more black men under the control of criminal justice agencies today than there were enslaved in 1850. And he said that on national television.
And how does that affect us here in this beautiful institution like USC? I think some of you were at a summit that we did earlier in the month where we were talking about access in higher education, in particular in highly selective institutions. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, our young boys, our young children are targeted. By the time they're 3 years old, if they're not at a particular reading level, then people are projecting them for incarceration, the likelihood of incarceration. So as much as we speak about access here, we also have to look at this issue of prison abolition.
No, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I've been trying to do recently, along with others who are involved in various movements, is to make the connection between state violence, institutional violence on the one hand, and intimate violence on the other. Because, yes, it's true that young black men, black boys are targeted by the repressive apparatus of the police. But at the same time, you have to consider that women are the most consistent targets of violence in the world. And also black women are targeted by the police. And especially black women who have mental challenges. You know, If you are emotionally or mentally challenged and you are black, you're a black woman, that combination can be lethal with respect to confrontations with the police. Check out how many black women with mental problems have been killed by the police over the last period. And I mention this because sometimes we get stuck. Our notions of gender are so rigid that when we make the point that black boys and young black men and men of color are targeted by the police, we forget about all of the women. And then we can't understand the connection with violence that happens in other venues, and not necessarily on the street, not necessarily at the hands of the representatives of repressive apparatuses, but violence that happens within relationships. And what are we going to do about that? And what does that have to do with state violence? I don't think we have begun to understand the connection. Where do people who inflict violence on their partners or their children learn that it is okay to use violence? Who told them that violence was a solution? They had to learn it from somewhere. So I guess the reason I'm making this point is that in answer to your question about my contemporary concerns, I'm really interested in understanding connections, seeing ways in which all of the various social justice struggles that we're involved in are connected, seeing the intersectionality of those struggles.
Well, I wish that I could be a student who gets to sit in Dr. Davis's classroom next year at Stanford, because that's where she will be. And you know, she's at this point in her life now where she gets to pick and choose where she wants to be. I hope I get there one day. But I say that to say this. You know, you have been an educator. You have been Dr. Davis for over 40 years in some of the most elite institutions in this country. UCLA, Stanford, ooh, both of those, it's hard for me to say, UCLA and Stanford.
And, yeah, but well, you have to remember, I got fired from my job at UCLA.
Yes, this is true.
Before your first class, you were fired.
And it's interesting. I taught at UCLA last spring.
Yes.
And I was introduced by the chancellor in the same hall where I had given the very first lecture of my academic career. He told a story. I mean, it was great.
Well,
but the story he told was not exactly the story I remember. Because I remember being, I loved teaching back then, but I had to have UCLA police, accompanying me to every class. They had to start my car to make sure there wasn't a bomb planted in my car. The chair of my department, Donald Kalich, who was absolutely amazing, was attacked and beaten up by someone who came to the campus saying that he was trying to find me to kill me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was a hard time. And we have to remember that. I don't want to forget. I don't want to gloss over our histories of, you know, whether we're talking about histories of lynching and racist violence writ large, or even in my own individual case, I don't want to forget those moments. And I think that's the problem with this country, that we're urged to forget. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Barack Obama gets elected, and we're told that we now inhabit a post-racial society. And of course, that's one of the reasons I think we have such an upsurge all over the world around cases of police violence that have been going on forever. People often assume that this is a new phenomenon, you know, that Michael Brown gets killed and then Eric Garner, but this has been going on since slavery. There's an unbroken line of racist violence, and we cannot forget that.
Thank you. One of the things that we were talking about in our green room was that, you know, the constitution of the classroom was different back then with regard to people of color, even at this time, even with regard to all this stuff going on, war, feminism, all these things. And, you know, certainly given the many classrooms that you have been in, you've borne witness to this issue of diversity or lack of diversity now and lack of access. What are your thoughts about the state of access for especially Black students in institutions like this today?
Well, you know, it's a shame that we keep fighting the same battles over and over again. You know, I was noticing teaching at UCLA last spring that there were more Black students when I taught there in 1969. And not only were there more Black students, but there were programs to, you know, guarantee that that it wasn't just a question of wanting a few Black faces here and there, but there was what was called a high potential program where the students had mentors, and it was an amazing program. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned it 40 years later, and no one has any memory of it. There's not even any institutional memory. Mm-hmm. And this notion of diversity, I have a hard time accepting diversity as a synonym for justice. You know? No, diversity is a corporate strategy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a strategy designed to ensure that the institution functions in the same way that it functioned before, except that you now have some black faces and some brown faces in the leadership. And it's difference that doesn't make a difference. Difference that makes no difference at all. So I think we have to begin to talk about justice, equality. We need some more substantive terms. You know, we don't have a racially diverse Supreme Court when someone like Clarence Thomas is perhaps the most conservative justice on the court. Mm-hmm. Read his decisions.
I thought it was just me. It's okay. I thought it was just me. I have a partner in crime here, so let's see what happens. You know, because I like another word. I like that word accountable. You know, so as we have these conversations, we need to introduce that word accountable, accountability. Let's see what happens.
Well, see, we need to start talking about free education.
All right.
Because that would solve the problem. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think it's good that Obama started with community colleges, right? That's good. That's just a baby step.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So we should use this opportunity to raise the demand for free education. People should not have to buy education like it's a commodity, like they buy a car or a house. It should be available.
So maybe that's the next mass movement, you know? Maybe that's the next mass movement. So I will leave that to you all.
The struggle will always continue. A luta continua. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very, very much. And that, I believe, concludes our program.